appreciate it very much. This evening, we have a theme in which perhaps the opera is considerably less interesting to us than the great story of which it is a fragment. Musically, the Meistersingers of Nuremberg is a most successful and satisfactory composition. But it involves so many elements that perhaps are not so well known. The story itself is rather light, not especially substantial, that we have been taught to regard it as a music comedy or an operatic comedy. This term is very successfully applied, largely due to the fact that comedy is carried by one person, the marker. And much depends upon his ability for the humorous situations. Actually, the opera has a number of very serious undertones. And like most great comedy, it must be a combination of involved factors astutely arranged. Now, our primary interest lies in the structure of what we term the German artisan musicians of that period. Head and shoulders above all the others stands the figure of Hans Sachs, whose historical estate, whose factual nature, is worthy of a lot of thought. Wagner actually goes so far as to introduce into his opera some fragments of the original music composed by Hans Sachs. But these fragments have been, of course, adapted by the master musician to his own purposes. Hans Sachs himself stands as by far the dominant figure in a movement which began considerably before his time and extended into the century after his death. And this movement, beneath the surface of the life of Europe, had its roots in a very great antiquity and in very solemn and serious matters. So we want to begin by a little study of this man himself. In the opera, he's introduced as a shoemaker. He was a master of the guild of the shoemakers. We remember another great shoemaker, and that was Jacob Böhme of Görlitz, the famous mystic. And just as Böhme worked both on the soul of the shoe and the soul of man, somewhat a similar situation existed with Hans Sachs. It is not generally known, for example, that Sachs wrote nearly 5,000 poems and over 200 plays. Nor is it generally recognized that he contributed a number of very serious works approaching political and economic problems with the spirit of the guilds. We also know from actual music introduced by Wagner the close affinity of thinking between Sachs and Luther, and that this shoemaker belonged to the great motion of the Protestant Reformation in Germany. Now, Luther was himself a guild man. He belonged to the guild of the watchmakers. And at the time of his famous difficulties with Rome, he was placed under the protection of his guild, which may account for the almost miraculous way in which he escaped the rack and the stake. In those days, something was practiced generally, a principle which descended from antiquity, namely that every citizen of any community, regardless of rank, title, manner of life, had to be an artisan. It was compulsory that every man knew how to make a living. So we find that even the kings belonged to guilds. And the ill-fated Louis XVI of France, even as late as the Revolution, belonged to the Guild of the Clockmakers. And one of the last things that he did before he was led out to execution was to repair the clock in the dungeon where he was kept. This development of an art, craft, or trade as part of the essential life of man goes back to the Greeks and Romans and was an essential principle of medieval Jewish life. Each person must have his trade. So the fact that a man belonged to a guild did not necessarily mean that this represented the extent of his attainments. Now, the guilds themselves have an interesting and important background. These guilds are undoubtedly the descendants of the great family guilds of Greece and Egypt, because in very ancient times, professions, arts, crafts, and trades descended in families. This was also true of medicine and the first physicians, belonging to the Asclepian cult, were themselves the members of the Guild of the Healing God. The purpose of guilds in those ancient times embraced many of the objectives of the trade unions that were to arise in the 18th and 19th century and the labor unions of today. But if modern labor and labor organizations made more research into the rules and laws of the guilds, we would have very far better labor conditions in this country today. The guild not only protected the workman from exploitation, it protected the employer from exploitation. It also preserved and protected the quality of product, a matter which would be of some interest to many buyers of today. It was the sworn duty of the guildman to mark his ware. His name had to appear, and he was bound and obligated that he could not mark any goods of which he was not proud. And if his goods failed in any way to maintain the quality or to produce the wear that was reasonably expected of it, the man, the guildman, was in disgrace, subject to the penalties of his guild, and very few broke the rule more than once. It was therefore a day in which the guilds, of which Hans Sachs sings so gloriously in the closing scene of the Meistersingers, the glory of the guilds. These guilds were glorious because they represented the glory of honest work, something we have totally forgotten in this time, this day of mechanized products. The glory of the man who made a good pair of shoes, and by that simple fact was entitled, like the ironmonger of King Solomon's legend, to sit beside the king because he made good shoes. In other words, a man did not have to be a doctor or a lawyer or a civil engineer to have the respect of his community. He was respected because he was skilled, and because his honor was beyond question, and because his products were well made. Now, these guilds had many religious overtones. And we know from the story, and it is quite true, that the Guild of the Master Singers met in the Church of St. Catherine in Nuremberg. Sometimes they met in the Court Hall. Sometimes, in less favored communities, they met in the alehouse or a room above the inn. It is even known that they met under a tree somewhere. But they were bound. They had their words, their obligations, and a kind of Freemasonic fraternity flourished among them. These guilds belong to what we have called on other occasions, referred to in Parsifal, as the Orders of the Quest. They were a non-theological religious body, a body which worshipped by the sacrament of honesty and united their efforts in fraternity and cooperation. Within the structure of the guilds, all men were brothers. Although the guilds had their degrees, promotion and advancement was by merit alone. All guildsmen were entitled to a share in the common good of the community and carried their part of the common burden. They had a ritual which was not definitely different from the Passover or the Lord's Supper. The guild masters gathered with their apprentices and their craftsmen around a table in the midst of which stood the guild cup, which was the symbol and sign of their movement or their order. And this guild cup was a kind of holy grail, and around the lip of it were hung on hooks tiny shields, each carrying the crest, the name, or the insignia of the guild master. When 12 of these masters gathered together around the great guild cup, and each drank together from the same cup, it was a Eucharist, a bond of common integrity, a restatement of an oath of obligation to society, to all things that were great and good and true, and among other things, a promise that the apprenticeship system would be maintained, and that no one should become a master of that guild until he was worthy, and that to be entered as a master was the highest honor that a man could have within his trade or profession. And on this level, he was entitled to the common respect of all mankind. It was among these guilds that we had the first organization to care for the widows and orphans of the deceased guild masters. It was here that unemployment insurance began. It was here that old age pensions were first devised, for it was within the guild that man set up his great protective mechanism of common responsibility. It was also within the guilds that democracy had its earliest and most powerful statement. And long before the political system of Europe permitted the emergence of democracy, it was practiced within the guild group. It was the law of the guild hall, and it was held as a sacred and solemn obligation. Now you can see that groups like this, scattered all over Europe, and particularly centered in Germany, that these groups of wandering or established artisans, each master with his apprentices, for it was not the proper duty of the master to have his secrets die with him. It was his proper duty to see that all the skill of the craft was passed on to those worthy to receive it, who were bound by obligation to in turn demand the same standard of integrity when their time came to pass on the secrets again. And today, after hundreds of years, we do not know and have great difficulty in discovering the secrets of the old bookbinders. the secrets of the early printers. We do not know today the secrets of the medieval tapestry weavers. These things were either lost or have still been handed down within family groups or within very small bodies of people, bound by the same rules as the old guilds. Now, the difference between the typical guild structure and that of the Minnesang, or the Meistersinger, was that these groups cut right through the guilds, in the sense that in the case of the Meistersingers, they were taken from any and all guilds. They were not reserved to the clothers or the shoemakers or the barbers. They had the right of initiating or accepting members in good standing of all guilds. Thus they became all over organizations. But by their peculiar level of thinking, they were non-competitive. And the individual who became a master singer was not in conflict with any other guild. Now, the principle that underlies the development of the master singers has to do, perhaps, with the condition of Europe at the time. Actually, most of the members of these groups, and they flourished in several cities in addition to Nuremberg, were square-toed, puritanical persons, solid, honorable, masters, and craftsmen. They would give the immediate impression of being dour. They lived in comparatively restricted communities. They plied their crafts and trades assiduously. They worked from dawn till dark. It is said that at that day, in those times, a tailor was at his bench from dawn to dark, and frequently far into the night. These men worked hard, and life was not by any means the comparatively luxurious state that we enjoy or suffer from today. Actually, these men were artists. They had artistry, because even the barber was an artist, and proud that he gave an outstanding haircut. The baker was an artist, and if you've lived in Europe and seen the way they prepare their breads and cakes and confections, you will know that he is an artist, and his soul went into it. Even the comparatively conventional tailor was an artist. And a shoemaker could be very proud of the fact that he alone could fit a difficult foot with artistry, skill, science, and a resulting product which the owner would be proud to wear. But most of these men were living under a very strict religious, political atmosphere. And among them rose this tremendous pressure. The pressure to release creativity, to go further than the mere trades and professions and crafts in which they were employed. They wanted creative outlet, idealistic outlet. They wanted dream and art. Most of them were what we would call moderately educated. This was not true of the Minnesang that preceded them. For this was composed mostly of nobles and of titled gentry. But many of these good guildsmen had had only maybe 6 months or a year of schooling, perhaps less than that. Very few of them had had any formal musical training outside of their own order. A few exceptions existed. But these guildsmen created their own laws and their own ways of music. And they had their book in which the rules, methods, practices of musical composition as they understood it, all these principles were carefully set forth. Now, there's one thing about them that was typically Teutonic and typically contemporary. They were not innovationists. The one thing that they demanded was a strict conformity with traditional rules. As a result of this strange and strict conformity, there was very little great creativity in the music of the master singers. It has not come down to us with the tremendous vitality of a Bach or a Beethoven. Not only because these were not trained, but because they were completely inscribed and circumscribed by small rules that almost prevented any creative expression. Wagner himself seems to have made a combination of identifications in his opera. We see in him a man who perhaps in his own day was the greatest rule breaker in the entire world of music. He was a man who opened the way for an almost complete break with many traditional forms of composition. And in the development and balance of orchestration and the relation of orchestration to the vocal ensemble, he made many important innovations for which he was severely criticized in his own time. And it is believed that in the character of Beckmesser, the marker, who supplies the principal clowning of the story, that Wagner was aiming directly at a music critic whom he did not personally like, and whose real name appears, incidentally, in the original score, but was afterwards left out. In other words, Wagner now plays the part of the man, the hero, Walter himself, who dared to break the laws of music and had persecution and difficulty as a result, but was finally victorious in the spirit of his own high resolution and optimism. So there is a little personal feeling and a little personal sentiment running under the surface of this opera, which carries as one of its messages the break between traditional music and a new era of creative composition, where Wagner felt that he was in a pioneer position. Another interesting sideline to this problem rests in the development of the theme behind the master singers themselves. We all have heard of the Irish Welsh bards. We know the Orphic rites of Greece with their emphasis upon music. We know about the minstrels and the troubadours. But what we do not seem to recognize or seldom consider is that there are relations between these groups. There is a descent of a great overguild of music, just as there was a descent of a great overguild of architecture. The musical guild did not have quite the same outcome as the architects' guilds, from which came finally the Masonic orders of Europe and America. But the music guilds and the great development of them did have important religious philosophical background. The Minnesang, or the 12 High German Poets, was a group that began probably in Provence, where the king was a minstrel, where the court was made up of troubadours, and where a strange, almost Arabian Nights world flourished for a time, and from this same area came the strange, somber, mysterious figure of Michael of Notre Dame, whom we call Nostradamus, who was associated with the court of Provence as personal guide, guardian, and physician to the king René of Provence, who was also at that time king of the Holy Roman Empire. So in this area, we find the rise of this guild of musicians. And we have one interesting note about the old Minnesang. These aristocrats of music, perhaps well learned in their various compositions, were called the doleful musicians of unrequited love. Quite a title to carry along through life with you. The Minasan was notable for sadness. You could always gather with them and weep copiously. Their songs had about them the sadness of hopeless devotion. Actually, we would consider them exceedingly mellow today, because like proverbial tragedy, nothing good ever happened. Everyone was dying of a broken heart in one, two, or three shops. It was a very sad and melancholy humor that pervaded these times. And the Minasan was nearly always devoted to these songs, like Walter von Eckenbach, these songs of the worthless, inadequate, miserable, helpless, and hopeless lover, addressing his song to a blessed damosel, superior to him beyond approach, so perfect that he could hardly conceive of her existence. And all he could do was to sing this last song and fall dead at her feet. It was a very mellow state of affairs. Now, it was also a very good Christian state of affairs at that time, because these sad singers, whose songs probably paralleled rather closely some of our old hymns in which nothing good ever seems to happen, were not suspected of their real motives. But as in the case of the Pre-Raphaelite restoration in England under Rossetti, the Blessed Damozel, of course, is the Virgin of the World, Sophia, Mother of Mysteries, Isis, the Great World Mother. She is forever that which is beyond human contact. She is Sophia, wisdom, the magnificent truth, the unassailable eternal reality, at the feet of which all men expire, and to which all turn their doleful songs, much as in the sad, heart-rending poetry of the Sufi and the dervishes of Islam. Therefore, this mysterious virgin was the human soul, was the mystery of a religious concept that had descended in Europe from the martyred Albigenses, had come down through the mysterious orders of chivalry, the Comasine masters of Lake Como, went on back to the mysteries of Manes, on through the Gnostics, back still further into Greece and Egypt, the song of man worshipping his own inner soul, the spiritual part of himself, which was indeed for him the bride of the Lamb. This mysterious bride, which is described in Revelation, in which the holy city, adorned as a bride, is united in marriage to the Lamb. This is also, according to the ancient belief, the Mother Church, which is the bride of the Lamb. And under the symbolism of the bride is the acacia, or the sanctuary, the place of those who come to worship, to offer themselves, body and soul, at the feet of the Beloved. Now this, if it had been expressed in good, clean English or German, particularly Low German, would probably have taken everyone to the stake or the rack or the gibbet in those days. But when the troubadours wandered about singing their sad songs, everyone thought they were mad. And that's not so different from the way it is now. If you break with tradition, if you're not content to be a materialist, if you even believe that a human being has a soul, you will probably be judged a little strange, even in this enlightened age. But of course, there is not much probability that you will be burned at the stake. But your friends may ridicule you for your strange beliefs. The troubadours were actually priests, bishops of the courts of love. The word minstrel means a minister or a priest, although it has gotten very far from that time by the occasion in which it reached the old-fashioned river boats on the Mississippi. But a minstrel man was a priest. A trouvier was a bishop. These bards and singers were the members of secret mystical orders who used these media for the perpetuation of their secret knowledge, much as the alchemists used their chemistry. And the rise of the courts of the rose, the romans of the rose, which is an acrostic, of course, rose being a rearrangement of the letters of the word eros, which means love. So that this mysterious symbol was always present in the rituals of the troubadours, just as it occurs in the final magnificent vision of Dante's Paradiso, in which the heavens unfold upon the petals of a thousand petaled rose. So the rose became the symbol of the heart. It was the crest sign of Martin Luther. It belonged to the great Reformation that struck Europe, in which authority was to be moved from the church to the heart, and each individual was to raise within himself the matchless altar of his own soul. The courts of love were therefore not places of debauchery, as those who were uninitiated were taught to believe, any more than Omar Khayyam spent most of his time wine-bibbing. These were symbols of the wine of life and the rose of great love, the rose and the lily. And around the motto of the ancient troubadours was the biblical quotation, "The rose of Sharon and the lily of the field." These represented the union of spirit and soul in man, the bringing together of the divine and human in a great Eucharistic mystery, the mystery of a sacrament. So these factors all flowed together to become the underworkings of the guilds. And the guilds took on this sacred destiny of perpetuating the improvement of men. And in the guilds and over the guilds, we find these other organizations that were not limited to a trade or profession, but had free access to many of them, and formed, therefore, a common meeting ground or a place of common connection. And when the courts of love were called, it was not for amatory reason, but to solve problems of state, to decide the courses of action under the tyranny of the times, and to protect the rights of man from the pressures of a feudal system which still dominated the European mind. Thus we have a new and greater respect for the guilds and all that they stood for when we learn to know them better. And we also have the realization that in these guilds, what we call comparative religion already existed. For in many of these guilds, there were members of other races. And when the cathedral builders gathered their guilds for the construction of a building, artisans came from as far as India and China to work on the cathedrals of Europe. These guilds were worldwide. And the same marks, the marks of the masters, appear on the Taj Mahal and Qutub Minar in Agra and Delhi as appear on the cathedrals of Europe. These same guilds belong to the order of the Society of Heaven and Earth, the great Chinese guild. And it was this guild that finally produced Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who, although he was a Christian, was also a member of a guild, the Hung Society, the rituals of which were entirely Buddhist and Taoist. But the purpose of the society was the liberation of China. Now this is the same thing that was moving in Europe. The liberation of men, the dignity of labor. the establishment of greater opportunity for human progress and activity. These were the things that men were fighting for. Fighting for the right to be people, to be human beings with minds and hearts and purposes. So through this heavy atmosphere broke the guilds of music, like the Meistersingers. These guilds were an internal release. These artisans found an opportunity to sing, to create, to dream. Their many songs have been preserved for us. Now, when the guilds came to the people in the form of the Meistersingers, a new atmosphere came in. The songs were no longer so dour and dismal. New values were introduced. The songs became more rustic. The songs rose from the people. And the Meistersingers became the audible voice of the German folk. And it is in the glory of the folk that Wagner finds much of his inspiration for the opera. Now, this term folk has come down to us in more recent years in psychology. We're recognizing it almost in the meaning in which it was originally used. Namely, that the total psyche of a people, the psyche which carries the arts, the crafts, the trades, the customs, the dreams, the overtones of a people, that not only do we have individuals with temperaments, but we have the collective temperaments of groups. And some strange mystical atmosphere hovers in the air, or makes the air over Europe. And this atmosphere also is further divided and refined, so that there is an atmosphere that is France, there is an atmosphere that is Italy, there is an atmosphere that is England. And if your eyes are closed, and on a speeding train or plane you cross the boundary of one country to another, you can feel it. What it is, no one seems to be able to say, but it is an intangible atmosphere which represents the total consciousness of an allied group. We are comparatively without the consciousness of folk in the United States, due to the fact that we have derived our people from so many different races, religions, and roots. This perhaps is why we lack, or have not yet built, what might be termed a cohesive spirit. We are still in an age of rugged individualism, in which we no longer or do not think of singing of the glory of the group. The folk represents the victory of the group over the individual, but not the tyranny of the group. It represents in a mysterious way the instinctive union of psychological force. The folk gives us the music of a people. The music and the chant, the ritual and the mass. The folk gives us the old songs, the folk songs, that are still nostalgic in our remembrances. There may be many pieces of music, but there are seasons of the year when Auld Lang Syne seems to be about the only thing that exactly fits the situation. This is folk. This is the mysterious, intangible power of tradition operating in the life of the individual. Now, tradition may be an obsessing thing when it is not good, but it also has a strange way of binding fragments together, making one out of many. And perhaps this is one of the great mysteries of music, the power to make one out of many. By the participation of the individual member of the choir, something happens musically in the consciousness and experience of the individual. He learns a strange way of expressing collectively, cooperatively, non-competitively. He does his part, and without his part, the perfect thing would not be attained. But he does not try to dominate. The purpose is to create the perfect fulfillment of the requirements of the music itself. Those gathered in a great music festival, listening to great artistry, forget race, nation, religion, everything else. They are one in music. And when some extraordinary achievement is made manifest, a vast audience rises as a single individual to herald this achievement. There is a strange, tremendous participation in which not only the performer, but the auditor, in some way becomes a living part of a tremendous tonal pattern, a tonal motion, a vibration in space. And this, to a measure at least, is the story of the folk. And of course, Hans Sachs sings of the glory of the folk. And in his case, it is of course the glory of the German people, because Wagner was tremendously conscious of this factor himself. Overconsciousness upon it produced a disaster of Hohenzollern and Hitler. But the principle, as it was expressed through the master singers, would not have produced this disaster of itself, because this was the creative expression of the people, the folk doing collectively something beautiful. Whereas under the pressure and tyranny of dictatorship or autocracy, this pressure became an hypnotic force to produce evil. But in the creativity of the master singers, this was the pattern of release for these men, releasing a creative instinct within themselves. Yet they were not strong enough, because of their time, to break the mysterious power of rules, regulations, by means of which they were musically confined and restricted. Another important phase of the story of this group has to do with the mysticism of the old master singers. You can get very little information about the inner workings of these groups. But by studying a few of the prominent texts that have descended to us from the troubadours and some of their contemporaries, we realize that these groups were divided roughly, the master singer definitely, into three grades, which corresponded to an apprentice, a craftsman, and a master. In this case, the grades were divided according to the achievement of the artist. One grade consisted of those who could write the words of a musical composition, but not the music. The second grade consisted of the individual who could write the music to another man's words. And the third, or highest grade, the master, was the one who could write both the words and the music, thus representing levels of achievement. The poetry of the master singers was exceedingly conservative, and in one of the simplest forms of verse composition that we know. They were not skilled in poetry. They only were able to maintain certain elementary poetic rhythms, and they would never for a moment have departed therefrom. If you go back, however, to the Greeks, you will realize that another great tradition descended within the structure of poetry alone, and that poetry was divided from prose by the very pronouncement of the Oracle of Delphi, which stated the prose was the language of men, and hexameter verse the language of the gods. So all things which had to do with sacred matters were originally placed in poetry as being symbolic of a rhythmic motion of words. Words as ritual. Words as mantram. Words as a combination of sounds and motions and rhythms in an effort to convey over meaning through rhythmic organization. So the songs, the mystical parts of the stories, were placed in verse. And the appropriate masters, if necessary, compiled the music, or prepared it, composed it, for the use of the poets. And in France, of course, we had the great rise of the French Pléiades, or the Pleiades, the great cluster of French poets under Ronsard. And this group of poets was up to its neck in politics, fighting like François Villon for the invisible empire of the beggars. And we think of him only as a ruler over outcasts. But this is far from the truth, because the great courts of the troubadours and trouviers were held in the sewers of Paris. Because it was here that the humble, the meek, who should inherit the earth, were called to their labors. All these things were tied together in a very strange and wonderful way. And they moved together into the great era of reformations, in which finally, after the development of the Western Hemisphere, after the destruction of the Spanish Armada, and many other things, the rise of liberalism became possible. And we had the era of revolutions, which resulted ultimately in the establishment of the democratic way of life on a political level. But all of this was pressed forward by thousands of years of conditioning. Men do not change overnight. Democracy was not achieved by the signing of a paper, but by the gradual development of instincts within the folk of people, within the souls of people. For only when the soul is prepared can it carry the burden of decision. Until then, it is not strong enough to speak and have its words heard and understood. Now, there is no evidence of any great or profound symbolism under the basic story of the Master Singers as we know it. There are intimations that Wagner was telling a symbolic account. But this symbolism is almost only pointing up the basic theme of the Master Singers themselves. It is inviting you to look up the major theme, not merely to be satisfied with the story. The story is extremely simple. It has to do with this group of solid citizens. And in the first part of the opera, we find them gathering in the Cathedral Church of St. Catherine in order to have their regular and proper meetings. Here we are introduced to the venerable, beloved, all-wise Merlin of the group, Hans Sachs. Here we also come to know other members of this rather august body. Dignified, majestic, with the simplicity of the shoemaker, the barber, the baker, and the tailor. And yet in this circle, they were all of consequence, and no royal court could have gathered with greater decorum. We also find that in this community was another guild, which is represented in our story by a wealthy goldsmith. Now, of course, the guild of the goldsmiths was certainly handling rare and precious materials and demanded great artistry. As we know from the reputation of Cellini and others under the great wing of the Medici, the great and skillful workers in precious metals. Now the prominent citizen, the fine member of the gold makers, or the gold workers guild, had a daughter, Eva. And he was a little concerned with local conditions. He had looked around among the rich burghers from whom he might hope to select a son-in-law, and was complaining and generally upset by the fact that he did not feel that local conditions were quite in order. The honor, the dignity of certain professions was apparently failing a little. Rich merchants and neo-nobles, where he might have sought, did not live up to his standard of a proper husband for his beautiful daughter. So gradually these conspiracy developed, with her consent, ultimately, that she would marry the winner or victor in the great competition of the master singers. In other words, whoever was awarded the wreath and chain of victory would then be entitled to have her hand. The young lady, however, put a proviso on it, namely that she could refuse to marry the individual. But if she did, she promised she would marry no one. So it was either the master singer or an old maid. So naturally, she was considerably concerned with the outcome of this particular competition that was soon to take place. Now, into this situation wanders a young Franconish knight whose name is Walther. And his background is a little mysterious because he is supposed to have been qualified. He studied under a great master of the old master singers, but this master had been dead for a very long time, and no one was quite sure of the rules that this other master had established and to which the young man must theoretically conform. It was not possible to know just how to judge him because of his remote connection. Also in this situation, we have another interesting dating problem going back to Wagner himself. This so-called comedy opera came to Wagner's attention as a theme, and he began to develop it about 1845. At this time, he was just completing Tannhäuser. And this was important because in Tannhäuser we have actually a fragment of the Minnesang, the older musical group which preceded the master singers. So strangely, these two operas are intimately associated. And in Tannhäuser, we see in the Venusberg sequences and things of that nature, fragments of the old initiation rites of the troubadours. A situation that perhaps has not always been given the attention that it should. But here we find, on the level of the Minnesang, a much higher, more mystical, and more profound level of meaning and interpretation. But in any event, young Walther, who is the hero of the master singers, obviously, inevitably, naturally, and operatically falls in love with the leading lady. That is a coincidence that can almost always be depended on. The hero nearly always becomes enamored of the heroine. There is, however, a mysterious interference here that becomes the basis, really, of the comedy factor in the story. And that is Beckmesser, the marker, the man who is the scorekeeper, so to say, and who has the right to decide whether or not one of the competitors, or any of the competitors, has kept a sufficient number of the rules to win the contest. Now, in their method of tabulating, they used a tabulator, or a group of ordinances upon which they based all of their findings. And instead of adding points to build a score, you build a score by reducing the number of points marked against you. It is a little bit like the story of golf, where the low score rather than the high score wins. Because the low score in this case means that there have been fewer errors or variations from the traditional form. Every time the singer poet broke the slightest rule of the tabulator or the list of inflexible and invariable principles that must be kept, a mark was put against him. And if a certain number of marks were put against him, he could not be a master, at least not with that composition. He would have to wait and try again. Now, Beckmesser was an elderly, roguish character who becomes the foil. He is the clown. Because he had a most excellent estimation of himself, and although he is not quite in romantic years, he also has his attention directed toward Eva, the daughter of the rich goldsmith. And he can see no reason why his rather ungainly personality should not be the winner. This causes him not only to perform a number of exceedingly clownish and ridiculous actions, but also to take a particular malice against young Walther, whom he recognizes as a potential rival in this situation. So as the murker, he has the right to make every possible criticism that he can think of in an effort to prevent the young man from winning his position of master within the group of singers. And of course in the opera we see the marker behind his screen or behind his little table with a curtain, and every time he can possibly find a fault in Walther's singing, there is great commotion and agitation behind the table, and with great ceremony the debit is marked against the young man. Everything is that's possible is done to annoy him, and Beckmesser becomes a very amusing character, especially if well played. But in opera you have to be fortunate to get a voice that can also be a good comedian, so sometimes much of the comedy is lost. But there is where it is essentially located. Now in this same situation, of course, we find Hans Sachs, an elderly widower, a kindly good man, who perhaps also had some aspirations to find in Eva a possible second wife. And because he was such a fine man, although he was rather elderly to be romantic, it is quite possible she would have favored him had not young Walther come along and captured her heart. But of course Sachs is the philosopher, the venerable, kindly man. So when he sees the way things are, he's a little sad, and Wagner explains his sadness in a series of very beautiful songs, but he immediately goes to work to help the young couple to solve their problem and to get together. He is not selfish.